speaker for this evening, Cecil C. from Saskatchewan, Canada. Cecil?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and believe me, I'm really grateful to be here. You'll never know how grateful I am to be here. I arrived on the airplane, and I was the only passenger on the plane. And two people came out to meet me, and they lost me. And that makes a guy think. And tonight I'm sitting talking to the chairman, and right in the middle of something I was saying, he got up and left me sitting there. And I got to thinking, maybe they really don't want me here, you know. I mean, when you get lost at that airport, and Howard and Graham, they're roaming around, and honest to God, I found them. And I asked them to bring me here, and they brought me here, but I really do feel that they were instructed to lose me. I first of all would like to bring you greetings from Max C., who talked at your one of the conferences down here a short time ago, and Max is a sponsor of mine, and I'm very happy to announce tonight. I am sure that many of you people don't know, but Max was stricken with cancer about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and he's had a very, very serious operation, but he's back jogging, he's back to work, and I talked to his doctor, and his doctor said, I have never seen anybody that has pulled out of an operation like this with an attitude like this man has. And I very humbly said that he was probably properly sponsored. But I was on the phone to Matt just before I came away, and Matt said to be sure and say hello to everybody down here. And I've been watching you people get around and put this roundup on, and I know it's not easy because I come from a town about the same size as yours, and I'd like to invite everybody up to our little roundup on the 23rd, 24th, 25th of this month. We usually don't tell anybody because we get almost 3,000 people there, and but you're such a fine bunch of people, I'll just share it with you that there is a roundup there, and if any of you care to come, I'll look after you. It's great for me to be here because when I was a delegate to the General Service Conference in 1958, I was a delegate with a very, very good friend of mine who's now passed away. His name was Libby. I'm sure some of you will remember him, but he was a buddy of mine, and Libby and I shared a lot at the General Service level and wrote many letters to each other, and Libby was always said, someday I'm going to get you to Oregon. Well, I don't know whether he had anything to do with it or not, but it sure took him a long time. And as I watched people putting this thing together, it reminded me of a story. Didn't really remind me of a story I intended to tell it all along, but it's the story of a golfer, and I know that some of you people know what golfers are down here. And this golfer had gone into the clubhouse one day after having a real bad game, and he was sitting there all by himself in the clubhouse, and he said, oh God, he was really upset with himself. And a voice came down, and he said, yeah, what's the trouble? He looks up, and he said, that you, God? And God said, yes, that's me. What's this been the trouble? And he said, well, I just can't putt. And God said, well, tomorrow when you're out, just move your hand around a little bit, and I'm sure that everything will be all right. So while he had him on the line, he thought he'd better ask him a few more questions or have a little conversation with him. And so he said, tell me, God, do they have a golf course up in heaven? And God says, just a second, I'll check. And he went away, and he came back, and he says, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. He said, first of all, for the good news, he said, they have the most beautiful golf course that I've ever seen. Well, the golfer said, well, what can be the bad news? And he said, your tea off time is 10 after 8 tomorrow morning. And that's why it's kind of important that we get along with each other. And that we, you know, really, the committee can all be good, and I'll tell you what, I'll get along real good with you tonight if you'll get along with me. And I'm just going to ask you if you'll sit still, because those chairs make a real bad noise. And I've been sitting down there trying to listen to the speakers. It wasn't the speaker's fault, it was the chair's fault. And I won't talk any longer than you can listen. And if you can just hang tough there for a little while, we'll get this thing over with. And they haven't paid my expenses yet, but I hope you'll pay them right after this. And I would like if you'd make arrangements for somebody other than Howard and Gwen to take me back to the plane. Because I would like to go home tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you much about my drinking because I don't think it really matters. I can tell you one thing, I'm not here by mistake. I did drink. I didn't drink for very long. I only drank for about 11 years. I started drinking when I was 16. I had my first drink when I was 16, and I had gone into the Army when I was 16 years of age. And I went into the Army because I didn't like the discipline of my home. I didn't like the discipline of my school. And I didn't like the discipline of my church. And to show you that I was much smarter than the teenagers of today, I ran away from home, and I ran into the Army. And I found out what discipline was all about. And I would suggest if there's any of you teenagers out there and you want to run away from discipline, don't try that route. And I had my first drink that night. First drink that I ever had. I grew up wanting to be an athlete. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, and I was a pretty good athlete. And that night I had my first drink, and man, it was just beautiful. All of a sudden, I found out I was from the farm, and I went into this city and joined the Army. And all of a sudden, I was just doing everything that I wanted to do. Sitting in this beer parlor, and there somebody was talking to me, and I could talk about anything he wanted to talk about. Some guy got a little upset with something I said, and all of a sudden, I had muscles. I told him where he could head in. We went to a dance, and all of a sudden, I was Canada's own Fred Astaire. My God, I was just great. Then I took a girl home, and I was Charles Boyer, and I was Clark Gable all combined. But the next morning, I woke up in that Armory's, and I was that same little scared boy that had joined the Army the day before. But every time we went downtown and I got drunk, I became what I wanted to be, and it was beautiful. I did very well in the service. I became an instructor. I got kicked out, mind you, when I was 17. I went back to Prince Albert, and I worked in an aircraft factory. Started making a little bit too much money, and all of a sudden I decided I didn't like the responsibility that I had, and I ran away from that. And I ran back into the Army. Told them I'd never been in before, and this time I was a genius. Became an instructor immediately. I was recommended for my commission, and I would just love to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Army, but I got kicked out before I took officer's training. I went back to my hometown, and I worked in the newspaper, in the advertising department, and that was really great. I was out in the street talking to people, drinking when I wanted to, and all of a sudden there I got too much responsibility, and I found out that I don't like responsibility. So I ran away from responsibility once again, and I ran into the Navy. And I got recommended for officer's training, and I went away to officer's training. And I would just love to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy. But I got kicked out of officer's training. I didn't get kicked out of the Navy, I just got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that an officer didn't tell me, he didn't appreciate me telling him what he could do with his ship. And I was went on that cruise out of Los Angeles last year, and I looked at that big ship, And it's an absolute physical impossibility for him to do. What I told him to do. And I became a gunner on a merchant ship, and I sailed all over the world, and I drank all over the world. I got married when I was in the Navy. And I'd like to stand here and tell you that I led her a fine life, but I didn't. I led her a bad life. After the war, I went back home. I got a job. I started losing jobs. I got other jobs. I started losing them. I went into business when I was 25 years of age. And I was in business for 4 months. And my wife, we went to this small town. My wife took our two little girls one morning and left. I went down and told my partner what had happened, and he kicked me out of the business. And I can remember that day so well. And that night, just by, because I knew where there was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to it. I didn't phone anybody, I just went there. And they talked about jails, and they talked about mental hospitals, and they talked about no shoes, and the seat bent out of their pants. And I guess all that had happened to them, I don't know. But I walked out of there that night, and I thought, my God, I don't even belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought that was about the lowest place in the world to be. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had nowhere else to go, I felt. And then I walked out of there so lonely that night. And had they talked about loneliness? Had they talked about fears? And had they talked about the things that I, those feelings that I knew? I know that I would have identified with somebody. I went out and I drank for another 2 years, and I caused a lot of people a lot of heartache. And finally, one day, I was in a poker game. I ended up playing a lot of poker, and I was in a poker game, and a guy in this poker game became a little narrow about something I'd done, like cheating, and we had a fight. Or I should say, he had a fight. He weighed about 275 pounds, and I thought he weighed about 118. And he hit me, and I hit the floor, and I got up, and he hit me, and I hit the floor. And we did that about 10 times, and finally I stayed down there. And I stayed there, and they took me to hospital. And that's when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know today why I became an alcoholic. The little town that I lived in before I went in this bigger town to join the army, it was a Catholic community, and I was a Protestant. And you too would have become an alcoholic had you lived there. They used to call the bingos in Latin, so I couldn't understand it. And I grew up resenting Catholics. And I had those feelings from way back before ever I drank. And this night that I went to hospital, what did they do? They put me in a Catholic hospital. And I had to give the lady, the little sister there, a bad check to have a private ward. We have now had Medicare in Canada, but at that time we didn't. And about 5 days later she came, and she couldn't find a place to deposit this check. And she was a little narrow, and because I was Protestant and she was Catholic, she wouldn't let me out of that hospital that paid the check. But I had a little doctor that sat down by my bed one morning, and he said, Cease, I can't do anything more for you. I have built you up physically, and now you're going to have to do something for yourself. And this doctor, thank God, knew me. He'd been in the service with me. And he said, you could have been an officer in the Canadian Army if you hadn't drank so much. And he said, I think you're an alcoholic. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, I think you should join Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God he didn't leave it at that. I was 27 years of age. I didn't think that I was an alcoholic. I knew there was something wrong with me. But I didn't think that I was down that low. And so he brought some members of Alcoholics Anonymous to see me. And thank God he brought the right people. He brought a man that I drank with, and he was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada, I am sure. And that night he came to see me, and he was looking good, and he was smiling, and he had a suit on and a silk shirt and a bow tie, and his shoes were shined, and he was clean, and he looked good. The other guy was a fellow that I'd been in the service with, and after coming back from the service, he got mixed up in a place in Edmonton, Alberta, and he hit a taxi driver in the head when he was drunk, and he got charged with robbery with violence, and he spent 5 years in our penitentiary. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous in that penitentiary. And I knew that something had happened to Earl. And they didn't have to talk, but they did. And I was embarrassed. I would say, how are things downtown? And they'd come back with, Chase, you got to cut it right off. And they told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought the whole hospital was listening to them. And I didn't want anybody to know that I was having anything to do with this Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was something like the three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you have alcoholic rabbits in Oregon or not. We got a lot of them back in Canada. I don't mean ordinary Saturday night drunk rabbits. I mean real, genuine alcoholic rabbits. They sit out by the fence and their ears are drooping down. And there were three of them. And they were called Foot, and they were called Foot, Foot, and Foot, Foot, Foot. And Foot, Foot used to phone him Foot, 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 and he'd say, let's pick up old Foot, and we'll go down to the bar. So Foot, 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 and pick up Foot, and we'll go down to the bar. And one night, Foot, Foot was sitting talking to Foot, 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 and Foot, Foot, Foot said to Foot, Foot, he said, what happened to Foot? And Foot, Foot said to Foot, 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 he said, well, old Foot was here, but he went outside. So Foot, Foot, and Foot, 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 they went outside, and they found poor old Foot, and Foot was dead. So Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, what do you think we should do with Foot? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, I think we should take him down to the funeral home. After the funeral, Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, what do you think old Foot died from? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, old Foot was drinking quite a bit. Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, do you think he's an alcoholic? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, I believe he is. So Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, you think we're alcoholics? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, I believe we may be. So Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, might as well, we got 1 foot in the grave anyway. When I was drinking, I used to use 5 rabbits. But I was like the alcoholic rabbit. I thought you had to have 1 foot in the grave before you came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went down and I met the people when I got out of hospital from Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were 14 or 15 of them came to see me. They had an emergency meeting on a Sunday morning, on a Saturday morning. It was about 25 below zero. The wind was blowing. And I wish you could have seen me that morning. No, I'm not so sure whether I wish you could have seen me. But I was... Nobody had come to see me at the hospital other than these two members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my suit was torn and my shirt was covered with blood from this fight I'd had. And I was sitting there with an overcoat on and I got my collar up so that people wouldn't see what I was looking like. And these guys start coming in. And they all came, the whole group. There was only one group there at that time. I guess they had a live one and they were all there. And after they had this emergency meeting with me, a couple of them took me home, and I said, well, thanks a lot. And they said, no, we're coming in with you. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't want you coming in, because Babe, my wife, she was always a little narrow. She'd come back to me after she'd left me that time out of business deal, and she couldn't do without me. And she was always a little narrow about me being away for 4 or 5 days. And she was like a lot of those Al-Anon women. And she was, my God, you know, it was embarrassing when I took people home with me. And so I thought, well, I'd just say goodbye, see them that night, because they told me I had to go to a meeting that night. But she came in, and thank God this was before Al-Anon in our locality, but some of the gals had been up to see her, and they'd told her what I was going to try to do. And I can remember her meeting me at the door, and if nothing else, this got me into AA. She said, I think everything's going to be all right, honey. And that wasn't the way she treated me usually when I was away on a drunk. And I thought, well, if this is good enough for me, I think I'll stick around. And I went to a meeting that night. We both went, Babe and I. They had an open meeting and they had a social. And it's just a little town like your town. And it was just beautiful. They played pin the tail on the donkey. You know, stupid games like that. And I thought, my God, this is not my idea of a Saturday night. But I looked around and everybody was having a good time but me. And then they had a meeting. And I can remember this fellow standing up and saying he'd been sober for a year. And I sat in the back and I thought to myself, liar. Couldn't be much of a drunk if you can stay sober for a year. And I knew him. I knew him real well because it's a small town. I knew he was a traveler out in the road. And I thought, well, he goes out, he gets drunk, he comes back in and tells these donkeys he's been sober, you see. And then they took me in another room. It was the kitchen. And they said, Cease, you're going to hear a lot of things. You're going to hear there's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they said, tomorrow morning, there's a meeting here at 8 o'clock and you must be here. And I've never stopped going. That was January the 16th, 1952. Because of you people, because of a loving God as I understand him today, because of this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never had to have a drink since that day. And I'll be ever grateful for what has happened to me. And it was just beautiful. I was the youngest member in the group. People patted me on the back, saying, you're doing a fine job, son. God, I just loved it. I stayed sober just by pats on the back. I used to break my anonymity. I can say that word, too. I used to break my anonymity to people that, anybody, as long as they'd pat me on the back. And then a horrible thing happened in our group. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me, talked to the older members. Older members walked right by me and talked to the newer members. And all of a sudden, I was a middle member. That's a terrible thing. And I mention this because no matter whether you're an Alateen or Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, one day you're going to be a middle member. And it's a bad thing to happen to you. Because you're like a hole in a donut. You're nothing, you know. You're just standing out there. And I decided, by golly, I think I'll go out and get drunk and come back in and get all the treatment I got before. But fortunately for me, we had a guy in our group by the name of Ernie Shear. Ernie's now passed away, so I break his anonymity. But Ernie was asked to chair our meetings for 3 months. And we have discussion meetings where I come from. And Ernie says, well, I'll chair your meeting providing you do one thing. And we said, what's that? And he says, we are going to go through the steps. And we're not going to talk about them. We're not going to read them. We're going to do them as a group. He said, I don't care who comes into the group. We're not going to go back to step one. We're going to start at step one. Somebody comes in at step six. We'll take them by the hand. We'll sponsor them properly. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to get everybody in this group through these steps. We're going to quit talking about them. We're going to start doing them. And so we thought we'd humor Ernie along, so we decided to go along with it. And that's what we did. And that's the experience I'm going to share with you tonight. The experience I've had since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started to look at those steps, those 12 beautiful steps, where it says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I found out that there was a second part to step one I never knew about before. And I found out that I did have an unmanageable life. I had an unmanageable life as far as money is concerned. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. I know that's not a lot of money down here, but it's a lot of money where I come from. In 1952, if you put it into inflationary terms, that's about $20,000. And I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. You know. You see, I came here by way of a poker game. And so I thought, well, by golly, things are going to be all right. And I had a big job. I got a good job right after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was making good money. But the guy I was working for, he got a little tired of me getting these phone calls and him getting phone calls. So he took me to the bank and he endorsed my note and they sent checks to all the people that I owed money to. And they paid all of my creditors off. And they made me sign a paper and my wife signed a paper that we would pay cash for everything. 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,500. So you see, I had an unmanageable life as far as money is concerned. Now, I know that this is stupid to talk to you people down here about this, because none of you have this problem. But I'm telling you what happened to me. And I found out that financial problems have nothing to do with money. They have a lot to do with ego. They have a lot to do with pride. They have a lot to do with big shotism. And that's what was wrong with me. And so I was spending this money like as if it was going out of style and getting myself in trouble. And I'll tell you what, if any of you ever do, and I know none of you have it, but if any of you ever get financial problems, please do something about it. Because they can, it is a bad thing when you're trying to live this program. Because I kept on being a greater liar than I used to be before. Because I had to lie to my creditors, I had to lie to my family. I had to play the role that everything was all right. People would say, how are things going? Great, you know, with a big smile on my face. And I had the football in my stomach. To show you that I've changed just a little bit. Several years ago, I owed a manufacturer $10,000. It's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money when it's about as hot as it is today. And this manufacturer was writing me letters and he was saying unkind things to me. And he like bankruptcy and closed me a door and everything. And I decided to do something about it. So I wrote him a letter. And I told him I liked his merchandise. I told him that I'd like to have fall dating on it. I told him I'd sold some, you know, with the small deposits. And then I threw a little philosophy at him. I said if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would seem like a long way. But if I took it a telephone pole at a time, it would seem even further, but I'd finally get there. And assign it yours truly, Cecil E. Corville, manager of C. Corville Furs and Fashions, P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. Sent the letter away. But 4 or 5 days later, that's when the post office was operating properly. I got a letter back. And he congratulated me on my letter writing ability. He suggested I get the hell out of the fur business, go writing letters to somebody. And he signed it yours truly, Mo Amsel, 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 Montreal, P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone call? I can owe him as many telephone calls as I want today. But you see, I was the kind of a guy, if I owed somebody $40, I wanted to pay them the $40 because I was a big shot. If I only had $38, sometimes I went out and tried to make the other two. Because I didn't stop gambling because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I'd be a little swifter now. And sometimes I'd lose the 38. And it's a bad, bad thing. And then it told me that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I went to some of the older members when we came to this step and we were doing it as a group, and I said, look it. I've never been in a mental hospital. How can I come back from somewhere I haven't been? And they said, look, Cease, it's not, you know, as Dottie said this afternoon, it's not insanity as such, but it's insane thinking. This is what they told me. And they said, you are a negative thinker, Cease. And I was. And I was especially negative if we were sitting around talking about negative about somebody that wasn't there. You ever see people sitting around in a restaurant trying to help somebody that isn't there? And they're saying things like, I heard, did you know, you know, all of those things. I was this kind of a guy. I was something like the negative barber. I don't know if you ever heard the story about the negative barber. A guy went in to get his hair cut. He said, like a haircut to last me for 3 weeks. Barber said, why 3 weeks? And he said, well, he said, I'm going away on a trip. Barber said, where are you going? He said, first of all, I'm going to London, England. The barber says, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you. He says, no, I've never been there. He said, but I heard it's a lousy place to go. Too many people, too many cars. Guy said, look it, I don't care. He said, if I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, I don't know. I've never been there. He said, but I understand they really fleece the tourists. Guy said, look it, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Rome. the barber says you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, too many Catholics over there. Guy said, look it. He said, I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but he said, I heard different kind of a Catholic over there. The guy went away. 3 weeks later, he came back, slid into the barber chair. Barber said, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He said, you didn't go to London. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He said, I did. He said, I'd love to have stayed there longer, but I wanted to get on to Paris. He said, you didn't go to Paris. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He says, I did. Loved to have stayed there longer, but I wanted to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. He said, I did. And he says, a great thing happened over there. He says, I got an audience with the Pope. He says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, you didn't. And he says, you'll never believe what happened. He says, I knelt down to kiss the Pope's ring, and he says, you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber says, what? And he says, where the hell did you get that lousy haircut? So I was something like a negative barber. See? I didn't know, but I'd heard, you know? And so they said, Cease, you've got an unmanageable life. I admitted that. Step two, I found a manager. And that's just, I had to keep it that simple. And they say, pray. And I'd say, who to? And they said, doesn't matter, just pray. And I did it, and it worked. They said, act as if. And by golly, it worked. I was staying sober. And then they told me that I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Holy malarkey, making decisions. I still have a tough time making decisions. And I watched some people in the lineup there tonight. And especially Al-Anons. Golly sake. They just have a tough time making decisions. And I haven't. And that's all they asked me to do, was make that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. And I still have this rough time. And I found out today that the reason I don't want to make decisions is because I'm afraid of making the wrong decision. Before I came up here tonight, I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. And speaking of wrong decisions, I have a friend of mine that went over to Ireland, and he's going down the street, and the guy stuck a gun in his back. And he said, what are you? And the guy thought real fast, and he thought, well, if I say I'm Protestant and he's Catholic, he'll shoot me. If I say I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he'll shoot me. So he says, I'm Jewish. The guy with the gun says, I'm the luckiest Arab in the whole wide world. So you see, sometimes we make the wrong decision. And sometimes we just can't make a decision. I heard a story about an old poacher. You people wouldn't know what a poacher is. But that's someone that, you know, fishes out of season, hunts out of season, before dark, after dark, whenever he wants to, without a license. And this guy was trying to catch him. This old, you know, those guys that go around with the badge, and he was trying to catch him, his game warden. Finally, he got all dressed up in old clothes, and he goes down and makes friends with the old poacher. And they're sitting there talking. The old poacher said, look, I'm going fishing. Do you want to come? It's out of season, but he's going anyway. So they get out there in the middle of the stream. He stops the boat, opens a box up, takes out a stick of dynamite, lights it, throws it in, boom! Up comes the fish, takes out a net, fills the boat up. The old game warden pulls the badge out, starts giving him the talk. He said, I knew I would finally get you. The old fisherman didn't say a word. Reached in the box, got another stick of dynamite, lit it on both ends. Handed it to the old game warden. And the old game warden sitting talking. And the fisherman said, look it, buddy. Do you want to talk or do you want to fish? Sometimes you're forced to make a decision, you know? And I think that's what happened to me. I finally made that decision, and I had to do it as simple as this. I had to say something like this. Look at God. I've done a lousy job of managing my life. How about you taking over? And by golly, it worked. Because I had this unmanageable life, I found a manager, and then all of a sudden I just turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager. And as I say, I had to keep it that simple. It may not work for you, but that's how simple I had to keep it, because I find out that if I complicate things, I get myself in trouble. I'm something like a friend of mine back home that had a ranch. And another friend said, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he says, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q, my wife wanted to call it the Susie Q, my son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q, and my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. Guy said, it's a hell of a name, but where are the cattle? And he says, none of them ever survived the branding. So you see, if I complicate things, I may not survive the branding. So I had to do it that way. And then they threw that fourth step at us. And remember that we're doing it as a group. And they threw that fourth step at us, where they said we had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And few people are getting up, you don't have to do it right now. Just, you know, it's okay to sit down. But they told us we had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And this Ernie was a pretty smart guy. Because you know what he did to us? He brought a pencil and a paper for each and every one of us to the meeting. Because he said, I find out the toughest thing about this fourth step in making this inventory, he says, is getting the pencil and the paper. So he said, we won't have any trouble now. We've all got the pencil and the paper. And then he says, now, if there's nothing wrong with you, he said, write it down, nothing. And then he said, write down right underneath it that you're a liar. You know. And he said, you've got something wrong with you. And Ernie was a pretty smart guy. He was a great guy. And he said, it's going to be difficult to do anything about ourselves if we don't know what's wrong with us. And he told us about this book. And we knew about this book. We'd spot read it, you know, we'd look through it a bit. And he said, on page 65, it shows us exactly how to do a personal inventory. Now, I plead with any of you, and I know you've all done your four step, but supposing there's somebody here that hasn't, and you're procrastinating because you're afraid to make a decision, because you're afraid you're going to do it wrong, and you're suffering from fear and everything, golly, if you are, get with it, because it's difficult. You know, if you don't know what's wrong with you, you can go through life like that, and that's a terrible thing. We had a little guy in our group one time, he said, fellas, he said, we had no girls in the group at that time. He said, fellas, don't jip yourselves. Get what's coming to you. And golly, the little guy didn't stay sober, but boy, oh boy, he taught me something. And I don't want to jip myself. I want to get everything that's coming to me in this fellowship, believe me. And I can get everything that's coming to me in this fellowship by this big book. They can show anything they want to me. They can give me all the books in the world, but if I do what it tells me to do in here, this book I find is just as current as the day it was written. And in page 65, it told me what to do. And I did it. And the rest of the group did it. And it was just beautiful because I found out what was wrong with me. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was something like the old lady that went to the doctor and she had gas. Real bad. The doctor said, does it bother you? She said, it doesn't bother me at all. She said, but I just thought it was something unusual. And he says, well, what happens? And she said, nothing. She said, doesn't smell, doesn't make any noise, just have gas, she said. So he gave her some pills. And she went away. He said, come back in a week's time. And she come back in a week's time. He said, how are they now? And he said, she said, oh, my God, what was in those pills? She said, it just smells horrible. And he handed her some more pills, and he said, now that I've got your sinuses straightened out, here's some for your ears. That's a horrible story, isn't it? But many of us are like that. We don't know what is wrong with us. So how can we do something about ourselves? Unless we write it down and find out. And this is what I had to do, was write it down, and I did that. And after step four, I found out a great thing. That step five comes after step four. And I found out another thing. That the toughest thing about step five was step four. And I found out another thing. The moment that I did my step four, I wanted to do my step five. Because I didn't want to be this way when I found out what it was. And another thing is, when I wrote it down, I couldn't lie to myself. Because I was a master at thinking things and justifying things and thinking that everything's going to be all right. And so I went off and I took that step five. And I went to a little preacher that I knew quite well, knew him very well, as a matter of fact. And I thought I'd shake him up by some of the things I had to tell him. I didn't shake him up at all. As a matter of fact, he shared a few things with me. He'd been a sort of orangutan too. Mind you, he quit preaching shortly after that, and he's now a parole officer, but I'm not taking full credit for that. And then it told me in this book exactly what to do. When I finished step five, by golly, they said, they're really smart people. They said, you go and you read step six and seven. And that made a lot of sense, because six and seven comes right after five. So I got this book out, and it told me exactly what to do. It said to study the last five proposals, which were the five steps. Find out if I'd left anything unturned. And they said, well, you know, make sure that it's good cement or something like that. I don't know what it was, but that you're building a foundation anyway, that it's a good foundation. And I read that step six and seven. Step six is entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven told me that I had to humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And it made sense. Because really and truly, everybody was talking up until this time about that great step four and five. Step four and five is nothing. It just told me that what was wrong with me. Step five, I admitted to myself, to God, when I wrote it down, I'm sure. Then I had to go and yak to another human being. But I still had all of those things. The only thing it taught me was that I had those things. Up until that time, I had an unmanageable life. I found a manager. I turned my will and my life over to the care of this manager, which I prefer to call God today. I took that inventory. I went and talked to another human being. And then in the 12 by 12, it tells me that step six is the step that separates the men from the boys. That is the step that really and truly, do I want to live like this, or do I want to do something about it? And I found out that playing poker was still a bad thing. I don't know whether it's a defect of character or a shortcoming. I have no idea. You ever seen people sit around at a meeting and discuss the difference between a defect of character and a shortcoming? Discuss it for 2 hours, go home, still don't know the difference, and don't know how to get rid of it. And I don't think that's the object of the exercise. It says we have to be entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character.
Please turn tape now. Do not run to end. Thank you.
I used to swear a lot, and I mean a lot, because I didn't have another vocabulary. I'd gone through life that way. And all of a sudden, I was in a job where selling mink coats, and a customer just don't seem to be prepared to buy with my vocabulary, you know? So I had to get rid of these things. And so I asked God to remove them. And I was a compulsive poker player, but I don't have to be anymore because of step six and seven. And step seven said we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Up until this time, I hadn't been down on my knees. Because I told people that I was working with, just pray any way you want. Riding horseback, standing up on top of a building in an airplane, riding in your car, walking around. But I never ever told them to kneel down. Because I wasn't doing that. And I heard a guy in New York one time, his name was Shy Walker. Shy Walker's now passed away too, it seems all of my friends have gone. But Shy was talking this night, and he was talking about coming out of prison. And he told how he so much wanted to stay sober. And they told him how to pray. But he couldn't get down on his knees. And he told about one night he came from work and he was wearing high-top boots. And he told how, quite by accident, he kicked his high-top boots underneath the bed. And he said the next morning he'd get down on his knees to get his high-top boots from under the bed. And he thought, by golly, seeing I'm down here, I think I'll say a few words. And he did. And every night he used to boot his boots under the bed, so that the next morning he'd have to get on his knees to get them. And I don't know whether it works with high-top boots or not, because at that time I didn't have any. But I know it works with ordinary shoes, because I tried it. And today I don't have to do that. I'm not one that goes jumping down the middle of the floor in front of the whole group. But I tell you what, I pray, and I pray on my knees. Because step 7 taught me a little bit of humility. And I think if there's any definition for humility, it would be the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And I learned that through those two beautiful steps. Step 8 told me that I had to make another list of all the people I'd harmed and become willing. Once again, it mentions willingness to make amends to them all. And I made the list, and I just reviewed my step 4, and I added some more people to it. Because I didn't stop hurting people because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's real strange. People say, look at him, he's in Alcoholics Anonymous. Or look at her, she's in Alcoholics Anonymous. All that happened to me when I joined AA, I admitted I was sick. And then this program taught me how to get well. And I don't know any other way but going through those steps in sequence that I could have got well. Now, I'm not saying that that's the way you got to do it. And I don't want you to say that that stupid Canadian come down here with a bunch of stupid Canadian propaganda. I want you to know that I got this from a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know that I bought that book in the United States. You know. So you are responsible. And then it told me that I had to make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I went about and I made these amends, and thank God I made them. Because on page 83 of the big book, and it's no use reading it to you because you all know what it says. Page 83 of the big book, it told me what could happen to me if I did everything. It said if I'm painstaking. It says if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, meaning the first 9 steps, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Isn't that beautiful? I can give you an absolute guarantee that those promises are true, because I've been one of those privileged people and I've experienced them. And I only experienced them because a little guy by the name of Ernie said, we will take these steps and we will do them in sequence. And he said, I don't care who comes in to the group, we're not going to go back to step 1 and discuss it. We're going to go through the steps. Thank God for Ernie, because he taught me that. And we did it. And we went on to step 10 and 11 and 12, which are those beautiful maintenance steps. And I'll tell you, let's share step 10 with you a little bit, because step 10 is so beautiful to me because it brought me back to this fellowship when I wasn't even away. That sounds ridiculous. After I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I came from. I became a big shot. I was working for a guy that was the wealthiest man in my city. And I decided he should be the second wealthiest guy. And I set about to make those material things, and I got some of them. But in my great struggle to get them, I became spiritually poor. And I didn't do step 10 each and every day as it tells me to do it in the book, where we continue to take a personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. And one day this guy called me into his office, and I was managing the largest ladies' wear store in the province of Saskatchewan. I was looking after the fur department for 5 big stores, and I thought I was indispensable. And he called me into the office, and it seemed that the store that we were both in just wasn't big enough for the two of us. And it seems that he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great Cease Corvo. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this. They won't last long now. I want you to know they're still millionaires and they're still doing pretty good. And that was a long time ago. And I had a little cousin, and I want to share this with you. My little cousin Fern came to visit me. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was going away to a roundup, something like this. And I went downtown and I bought myself a brand new suit. And I went down to see my little cousin, and I stood up in front of her in my great grandiose way, egotistical. And I said to her, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And she said these few simple words, and I'm going to share them with you and hope that maybe they'll help somebody that maybe someday will go through the same thing that I went in his 10-year sobriety. She says, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" And I went away to this little roundup, and I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is a big city. And I got in a hotel room for a couple of days just with God and myself, and I decided to what I was going to do with my future. And I went back to my hometown, and I went into business for myself. That's not important. I had to do something. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and started doing what I was supposed to be doing. Now, I had never left. I was going to meetings. But I was going to meetings with an attitude something like this. "You lucky people, here I am, you know. And I hope to God this never happens to anybody." But it can happen whether you're an Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. It can happen. If you don't do those maintenance steps, and I wasn't doing step 10. Today it's just beautiful because each and every night I take a look at old Cease. And I don't take other people's inventory, I take mine. And when I'm wrong, I can promptly admit it. And I'll just tell you that I don't like being wrong. And I don't like promptly admitting it. And they work together, so I try not to be wrong. And it's just beautiful. And it's given me a brand new way of life. And then we came to that beautiful 11th step, where it says, "Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out." I think if you count that step, it probably has 16 or 17 more words than any other step. So I told you I wasn't too smart, and that I kept things simple. And I figured, well, it takes quite a bit to do this step. And one time I found myself going to work, and I found myself having an argument with a guy that was about 1,300 miles away from me. He was in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I was going to meet him in Montreal at a fur convention. And I found myself having an argument with him. And all of a sudden I started to have that argument out loud on my way to work. And I stopped at a stop sign, and some of my friends drove up beside me, and there I was, just screaming at this guy. And it's difficult to do because he's not there. And you got to figure out what he's saying so he can answer him, you know. I got in front of my store and I wasn't finished the argument, and I drove around the block a couple of times because I had a few more things to tell him. And I got to my store at 8:45 in the morning completely exhausted. And I don't want to live that way. And I find out that I don't have to live that way. Because if I take this beautiful book and I go to page 86, 87, and 88, it tells me exactly how to live. It tells me on awakening. Now some of you may say, "Well, by golly, that's pretty early to be doing that." Depends what time you're waking up, you know. If you get up at 6 and don't waken up till 12, well, don't do it till 12. But I do it early in the morning because I'm waking up then. And it's just beautiful. I have prayer and meditation. No matter where I am, this morning I spent some time in your beautiful park, and it was just wonderful. Because I don't like driving to work arguing with people that aren't there. And so I have to do something about me. Not about you, just about me. But I can share this with you. I read the prayer on page 63, and I read the prayer on page 76, and I read the last part of A Vision for You. I used to call it 7 minutes with God. Now sometimes it's a half hour. It doesn't matter. My dear little wife, she's really upset because never can she have an argument with me at 7:30 in the morning because I've done my reading. And she can talk about anything, and I just take her to the mirror and I said, there it is, honey. If you want to argue, argue with babe, not with Cease, you know. Because you see, I like to go to my store, and I like to walk into my store, and I like my staff to come in, and I like to greet them the way that I like them to greet customers. And I run a pretty successful store. I have 18 ladies working with me, not for me, but with me. And we just do a fine job because of page 86, 87, and 88. Because my attitude is right. And it's contagious. And if some of you are having a bad time in the morning, I'll give you an absolute guarantee. You read page 86, 87, and 88 every morning for a month, and I guarantee your life will change. And someone will say, I'll have to get up early. That's right. But don't chip yourself. Get what's coming to you. It says in the book we'll go to any length. We stay up pretty late, go to bed a little earlier. You have to do a lot of things to do these things. And I read other things. I read sometimes something maybe by Vincent Peale or Emmett Fox, because it tells me there that I should go and, you know, talk to my minister. It says, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer. It tells me that on page 87. So I use that. And I want to share something beautiful that happened one time. Several years ago, I had two little granddaughters and a little grandson. When my first granddaughter was born, they lived about 2,300 miles from us, and when I used to be coming from speaking or used to be coming from business trips or something, I would stop in and see them. And she was always packed, ready to come home with Grandpa. And the first time she came home with me, the next morning I was doing my reading, about 6 in the morning, and she'd heard me up, and she came and she knocked on the door, and babe said, honey, you can't go in there, this little room that I do my reading in. She says, Gramps is doing his reading. And she said, I have something to tell him. So I said, let her come in. And she came in, and I told her what I was doing, and tried to explain it to her. And then I said, what did you want to tell me, honey? And she said, I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And I said, I want you to know that I love you too. That may not mean a thing to any one of you people out there. But what it means to me is here's a guy that couldn't give love, couldn't receive love, but because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned how to give love and I learned how to give of myself and I learned how to get it back. That tenderness that every one of us so much need, I learned how to receive it back. She has a little sister that takes just about as much of my time as she wants. She just leaps up on my knee and says she loves me. And you know, it's really strange because I'll tell you what, their mother, I gave her everything that she could possibly have. Material things, love, and everything. And guess what she did? She married a Catholic. You know. An Italian one. That's the worst kind. And these two beautiful little girls, these two little Italian Catholic girls, They go to a Catholic school and Grandpa sometimes drives them. And I wave, you know, to the little nun there. She says, "Good morning, Mr. Cordell." Because, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that I don't have to live that way either, that I can have an open mind. And those things can be all right. They have a little cousin, and he's my real pal. And he and I share a lot of time together. My store is closed on Monday. He's 6 years old. Howard took me down to a beautiful store today, and we bought them some nice clothes. And I do that every weekend. My God, they got a lot of clothes. And he and I just do a lot of things together. We go hiking, and we go just wash the car, and we just have a time. I phoned him just before I came down here. He comes to AA with me, and he listens to my tapes, and he said, "Really, knock him dead tonight, Grandpa. You know, boy, oh boy, I think he's going to be one of us one day." But he and I, we were getting the car washed one day, and there was a Kentucky Fried Chicken deal there, and he said, "Let's buy some chicken for Grandma for supper." And I said, "I think that's a good idea, Jason." And he said, "While we're at it, we might as well get some for ourselves, you know." And we went home, and he had the grandchildren have a little table and chairs down to our house, and he wanted me to sit there with him, so I sat there with him. And he said, "You know what I want to be when I grow up, Grandpa?" And I said, "What do you want to be, Jason?" And he said, "I want to be a grandpa. And I want to have a store, and I want to be the boss." And that may not mean anything to anybody, but it's the biggest compliment that I've ever received. Where a little guy wanted to be like me, and a little guy wants to do what I'm doing, and he loves me and I love him, all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're just nobody unless you belong to AA or Jason, I'll tell you. I introduce him to all of my friends, and I call him my pals. And I said, "There's another pal of mine," and boy, that's great. He stands there and looks at you. But if I meet somebody in the street, he's with me, and I don't introduce him as a pal, he'll pull my head down to him, and he said, "Been AA?" And I said, "No, let's go." You know, no time for these mediocre people, these civilians. All of this because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. To me, it's just a personality change that I've been privileged to have by going through those steps. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I figured that out is that was taking those steps in sequence and coming to step 12. And I was entitled to that when I got there. And then it says, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. I'm going to make you an absolute guarantee that there's somebody in this audience tonight that's suffering, that there's somebody that's got a football in their stomach. There may be an Alateen, there may be an Al-Anon, there may be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, we worry about public information. And I don't think we're having problems getting people to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I think we're having a problem keeping them here. And I think before we leave tonight that we should turn to the people on both sides of us. Tell them that we love them and tell them that we want them and that we need them. Because little Bobby Motherwell, the night that I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, he put his arm on my shoulder. And he said, "Cease, we want you and we need you and we love you." And nobody had said that to me for a long time. And it's over 28 years ago, and I still remember it, so it must have meant a lot to me. I didn't think anybody needed me. I didn't think anybody wanted me. And I was positive nobody loved me. So do that tonight. We can carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers that is right in this room. And let's try to do it. And then it says, practice these principles in all our affairs. When I started to talk tonight, I said, we do not know when our tee-off time is. So let's try to practice these principles in all our affairs. We've had a good time this weekend. I've watched people throwing their arms around people and kissing and hugging and rubbing up against and just having a great time, you know?
It's just been beautiful. But what's going to happen when we leave here? You know, we get heading down that old freeway and we're going down there, and suddenly that dear little Al-Anon gal said, "My God, I forgot my suitcase." That's when you practice the principles. You know. You go back and you get the suitcase. And you're trying to make up time and you're going 60-some miles an hour, and all of a sudden, the red light right behind you. And the highway patrol picks you up and you bring up the suitcase. And you say, you know, if you hadn't been for that, what kind of a suitcase, you know. That's really not practicing the principles. You see, it's easy to practice them here, but what's going to happen when we get out of here? 2 miles from home, we run out of gas. And once again, we mention the suitcase. And I don't think that's practicing the principles. And I once heard a story about a little Al-Anon gal. She must have been from this area because she had a lot of money. And she was trying to sober her old boy up, and she just couldn't sober him up. And so she decided to take him on a trip. And she took him on a trip. And he was drunk when they got on the plane, and he was drunk. He got drunker on the plane, and he got drunker when they got over to Europe. And so she took him for a walk to try to sober him up. And they came to one of those great big wishing wells, those of you who've been to Europe. And they stood up there, and they threw their money in. And they made their wish. And the poor old drunk fell in and drowned. And you know what that sweet little Al-Anon gal said? "Holy hell, this thing really works." I don't think that's practicing the principles. And there was this other Al-Anon gal. She sat down in the bus one day, and she's sitting there, and she, all of a sudden she said to the lady sitting beside her, "My gee, boy," she said, "I forgot to pay the bus driver." The lady beside her said, "Look at it, the bus driver's not worried about what you're worried about." She said, "Look at it, I just joined a program that demands rigorous honesty." And she said, "I have to pay the bus driver." Her newfound friend says, "Look at it, buy yourself a halo, save the money." You know, and she said, "No, I just joined this program and it demands rigorous honesty and I'm going to go and pay it." She went up and she came back and she says, "I told you honesty paid off. I give him a dollar and he give him a change for five." I don't think that's practicing the principles. But thank God we've got principles to practice. Isn't it beautiful? And I can tell you one thing, that it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And each and every day I'm going to try to do as I've told you what I've tried to do. And I hope that each and every one of you will try that. Because it's important. It's really important to do that early morning work. Because we never know who is out there trying to get at us. Some of those civilians, you know, they don't know. And they aggravate our disease with some of the things they say to us. So we have to be ready for them. And I'm going to tell you one more story about another old poacher. And he was doing the same thing as this last guy was doing, and the game warden was trying to catch him, and the old game warden's name's Ralph. And he couldn't catch him. And finally one night he went out to the old poacher's shack, and he bedded down out front. And he thought, "I'll get him in the morning." 4 o'clock in the morning, the door squeaks open. A voice yells out, "Want some breakfast, Ralph?" And Ralph wondered, how in the heck did he know I was out here? So he goes in and he's having breakfast. And he says, "How did you know I was out there?" And he says, "I didn't, but for the past 5 years, I open the door every morning and say, 'You want some breakfast, Ralph?'" He just doesn't take a chance. And why should we? You know, tomorrow morning, think about that. If you haven't got a big book, they're back there for sale. And they'll even put a bookmarker in, 86, 87, and 88. And I want you to try it. You're probably all doing it. I don't know what I'm talking about this for. Probably up this morning before me, doing all those wonderful things. Folks, it's been a real pleasure to be here. I've had a lot of fun and I've enjoyed the hospitality, believe me. It's just been great. And I wasn't really supposed to come. I had a big thing that I had to do in Prince Albert last night, the responsibility in my own town. And I had a crew of people coming up to see me, a delegation of people, and they were going to phone Jim, and they were going to ask Jim if he let me off the hook so that I could emcee this big sportsman celebrity dinner last night. And they were coming at 8 o'clock, and it was on a Thursday night, and our stores opened Thursday night, and Jim phoned me about 7 o'clock, and he was so enthusiastic. He said, "God, we're really waiting for you to get down here." And he never gave me a chance to say that there was a possibility that I wasn't going to come. And those guys came up, and what they were going to do was phone Jim and tell Jim, the guy that's in AA from the radio station, he was going to tell him the problems they were having. And I've emceed this thing for 14 years, and they've changed the date. And, you know, but I'm glad. I'm sure they had that deal last night without me because I don't think I'm that important, you know. But I only think that because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've learned that. And I'm glad I'm here tonight where I'm supposed to be, because I love every one of you people. And there's a little town just out of sight of Omaha, Nebraska. And it's a little town called Boys Town. And as you drive up, you see a statue. And it's a statue of one little boy carrying another little boy. You can tell by the way he stooped over and by the sweat on his brow that he's having a very difficult time. But underneath there are simple words, something like this. "No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother." And that's what I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee and Jim for inviting me here because I've had such a great time. I want to thank all of you people for being here and for being such a great audience. Last but not least, I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day and allow me to do one more thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's a privilege. I think that it's a God-given privilege. And I'm going to share a little something with you, and I hope it'll help you as much as it's helped me. Every one of you out there tonight look real good on the outside. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless you.